Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times. I'm Rob Lund, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the April 14th issue. Our first article is about theater. It's entitled, Huey Lewis Lost His Hearing. That didn't stop him from making a musical. Written by Dave Itzkoff. After Huey Lewis learned that a syndrome of the inner ear called Meniere's disease had caused him significant hearing loss and left him unable to play or hear music, he faced the difficult task of having to tell his friends and peers. Lewis, whose wry lyrics and rumbling vocals powered Reagan-era pop hits like I Want a New Drug and If This Is It, turned to people like Tico Torres, the longtime Bon Jovi drummer whom he'd gotten to know on golfing trips. But their conversation proved to be an unexpected source of the pragmatic philosophy that Lewis built his career on. Over a breakfast interview last month, Lewis delivered a lively solo reenactment of that fateful talk with Torres. He goes, "Hey, Huey, how you doing?" Lewis recalled. "I say, Tico, it's not good." And I begin to explain. I said, "I've lost my hearing and I can't hear pitch. I can't sing." I'm telling him the whole story, and he's going like this. Here, Lewis lowered his head, furrowed his bushy brows over his eyeglasses, and shook his head in dismay. Slipping into an imitation of Torres's New Jersey accent, Lewis said, "When I finish," he goes, "what are you going to do?" "So that's my mantra," Lewis continued. "What are you going to do?" Really, it's a pretty good question. I don't know. Still working on it. Lewis had already halted his performing career before he went public with his diagnosis in 2020, but while his relationship to his art has fundamentally changed, he's continued to work on a new Broadway musical, The Heart of Rock and Roll, which is built around many of the songs he made famous with Huey Lewis and the News. The musical, which opens April 22nd at the James Earl Jones Theater, spins Lewis's tunes like Hip to Be Square, Working for a Living, and the title track into a fictional story set in the 1980s about a couple, played by Corey Cott and Mackenzie Kurtz, torn between pop star ambitions and corporate opportunities. It is a project more than a decade in the making, one that began before Lewis learned about the disease that has upended his life and given the musical an unexpected sense of urgency. As Lewis, now 73 years old, explained, "Zen Buddhists say you need three things, something to love, something to hope for, and something to do. I got plenty to love," he continued, "so this is my hope for and my to do. Keeps me from reflecting on my expletive hearing." A gregarious, exuberant storyteller, Lewis will readily regale a listener with tales from his picaresque career, like his formative days in Clover, a Bay Area band that arrived in London just in time to see their country rock sound become swept away by the punk movement, or the hours he spent driving to set with Robert Altman when Lewis played a role in the filmmaker's 1993 ensemble comedy-drama Shortcuts. Recalling some of Altman's device, Lewis said, "He told me, learn the script, read it every day, find your character to the point where you know what he had for breakfast, and then don't listen to anybody." Lewis's fellow musicians describe him as dedicated and reliable, which comes across in Bao Gwyn's documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop, about the making of the 1985 all-star charity song, We Are the World. In response to email questions, Lionel Richie recalled Lewis coming onto the project at the last minute, taking over a part that had been written for Prince. Even so, Richie said, "I remember him eagerly jumping in with confidence and patience. The Huey we saw in the documentary all those years ago is the same Huey we see today," Richie added. Fast forward to the night of the documentary premiere. He was still a nervous wreck over that night while watching the screening. His humor, his compassion, and his welcoming spirit are just a few of the things that haven't changed since the day I met him. In person, Lewis can hear well enough to conduct face-to-face conversations. He sometimes uses a discreet, disc-shaped listening device, which broadcasts wirelessly to a hearing aid in his ear. But when he is in a group setting, Lewis said, it can feel as though he is in a cocoon. "I sit there like this," he said, pretending to nod and smile at nothing in particular. Can't hear a thing. Lewis is also candid in talking about the despair he felt after learning that he might never be able to perform music again. Though he had experienced hearing loss in his right ear since the 1980s, he said the hearing in his left ear became suddenly and significantly distorted before a show in Dallas in January 2018. "I'm mainly a half-full guy," Lewis said, "but what followed were the most miserable 6 months of my life. I contemplated my demise," he said. "I laid in bed. I tried acupuncture, cranial massage, chiropractors, all organic diet." No matter which doctors he spoke to or which cures he tried, Lewis said they all yielded the same results. Nothing. In that period, Lewis said that talking to his grown children, his son Austin and his daughter Kelly, is what eventually gave him the confidence to move forward. They said, "Come on, Dad, get out of bed, Dad," he explained. When Lewis felt able to resume work, the Heart of Rock and Roll, several years into its development, was ready for him to return to it. The production's origins trace back to 2009 when the producer Tyler Mitchell contacted Lewis about turning his music into a stage show. Mitchell, who once bagged the musicians' groceries as an adolescent when they both lived in Ross, California, said several songs already had a narrative thread. "His songs resonate with so many people because they tackle a lot of relatable subjects, following your dreams versus playing it safe, love and relationships, friendship, blue-collar working," Mitchell explained. In his idealized version of the show, he said, Lewis's songs would provide not just the score, but a massive part of the actual storytelling. But Lewis, who has done two stints as Billy Flynn in the Broadway revival of Chicago, had been approached with similar offers and was wary. When it came to the genre of jukebox musicals, he and his creative partners refer the term catalog musicals, a show was not guaranteed to be a hit just because it used popular songs. As Lewis put it, "If the Beach Boys can't succeed and ABBA does, I'm just saying, but what we forget about Mamma Mia is that the book really is great." Lewis wanted a show to tell a compelling story, and he felt he found that in a pitch from the screenwriter Jonathan A. Abrams, who wrote Juror No. 2. Abrams said he began constructing the book's musical by writing down lyrics to the group's various songs, hanging them on his wall, and studying them in obsessive detail. "I stood back like I was looking at a painting," he said, "and words would jump out, hip and heart and soul and power and love. From there, I was able to start to formulate what this thing is demanding to be." Lewis did not particularly mind that the show does not tell an autobiographical story, explaining that many of his best-known songs were only ever loosely based on his life. "You know, the muse comes when she comes," he said. "It's usually from something personal, and when you begin to write the song, you exaggerate, you embellish." Readings and workshops followed, but only a few weeks before announcing that the show would have its premiere at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, Lewis experienced his abrupt hearing loss in Dallas. The show's collaborators learned about this from Lewis soon after. "It was very, very painful to watch and happen to such a great person who loves music and loves performing so much," Mitchell said. "To have that part of his life taken away from him was truly difficult." But Mitchell did say he did not contemplate halting or canceling the plans for the musical. "Huey would never let that happen," he said. "Huey doesn't give up." At the Old Globe, Lewis was on hand to contribute and to step back when he felt he wasn't needed, said the musical's director Gordon Greenberg, who directed the 2016 Broadway production of Holiday Inn. "He was there every day in rehearsals, 9 a.m. with us, laughing and offering suggestions," Greenberg said, and also understanding where he said, "Here's what I'm seeing, but I'm going to just let you guys go." Lewis, who attended several performances of The Heart of Rock and Roll at the Old Globe, said with a chuckle, "I kept wanting to redirect, to change things. Oh no, he's doing that all wrong." He added, "I can't get objective about it, and that's what I'll do with this show forever. But I love it, and I like where we're going." Reviewing the Old Globe production for the Los Angeles Times, Charles McNulty wrote that one's enjoyment of the musical will most likely depend on how nostalgic you are for Huey Lewis and the News, adding that his own surreptitious survey of theatergoers suggests this kind of material must have a pleasant, tranquilizing effect. Lewis has contributed a new song for the Broadway production called Be Someone, for which he shares credit with his bandmate Johnny Calla and the show's musical director Brian Usifer. I sang the parts into my iPhone and sent them to Johnny, and Johnny demoed it all up and tweaked it, Lewis explained in a phone interview, adding that this was a new process for him. I can sing to myself, he said, but I can't sing to anything because I can't hear pitch. We just changed the lyric 2 days ago. You gotta pick your battles. Lewis is considering cochlear implant surgery and is scheduled to have a consultation this spring. He said that in his day-to-day life, he has gained a greater appreciation for pastimes like reading and fishing, but that nothing will ever quite replicate the pleasure of simply listening to a jazz album while he's cooking at home. I don't miss doing 5 shows a week, he said. I don't miss travel at all, but I do miss a show once in a while, and I miss the circus that was our show. But okay, take away singing, take away performing. I can't even enjoy music. And yet, Lewis said the heart of rock and roll has given him a new appreciation for his own music because the show presents it in new ways and makes narrative connections across his body of work. There's a personality in the songs that I only recognized when I saw them performed in the show, Lewis said. I realized, wow, there's a thread that runs through all these. It's not my story, but there's a sensibility that pervades everything. Seeing his decades-old music reflected back at him, Lewis came to realize it was not just working, but living and thriving in the production. To see the songs take on this other life, he said, it's like seeing your children grow up and get a job. Now we will turn to the subject of music, and the article is A Conductor Who Believes That No Artist Can Be Apolitical, written by Joshua Barone, reporting from Munich. One by one, the singers came out to bow. They had just finished a performance of Mieczysław Weinberg's little-known The Passenger at the Bayerische Staatsoper, or Bavarian State Opera. Each received not just respectful, but also enthusiastic applause. The loudest cheers, though, were reserved for the conductor, Vladimir Jurowski. Now in his third season as the opera house's music director, Jurowski, age 52, is attracting the kind of adoration from the Munich public that was routine under Kirill Petrenko, who left in 2021 to lead the Berlin Philharmonic. But Jurowski is not merely winning over audiences. He has maintained the Bavarian State Opera's reputation as one of the finest, if not the finest, companies in Europe while pushing its repertoire in new directions and rooting his artistry in political awareness. We classical musicians tend to keep ourselves away from politics, Jurowski said over lunch in March. We always say that the music should be apolitical. Music can be, and art can be, but people who are making art should not be apolitical. At a certain point, it becomes not about politics, but about ethics. The new productions that Jurowski has led in Munich include Shostakovich's satirical The Nose, directed by Kirill Serebrennikov, while he was still under house arrest in Russia. Penderecki's The Devils of Loudon, an allegorical tragedy about fanaticism that read in the moment as a warning against cancel culture. And Prokofiev's War and Peace, staged by Dmitry Chernyakov, as an indictment of Russian nationalism after the invasion of Ukraine. When Jurowski started at the Bavarian State Opera, there were grumblings among audience members that his changes to the repertoire could come at a cost of the classics. But he has led new productions of standards like Der Rosenkavalier, Così fan tutte, and Die Fledermaus, and will embark on Wagner's Ring beginning this fall. And the audience hasn't resisted. Attendance, as usual, continues to hover around 95%, which is extraordinary for opera. You can try to convince people of your vision one by one in private conversations, but I think you can only persuade by the quality of the delivered product, Jurowski said. That's what counts. After years of a peripatetic career, Jurowski has consolidated his work in Germany, where he has lived since the 1990s. He grew up in Moscow and was born to an extremely musical family. His grandfather was a Soviet film composer. His father was the conductor Mikhail Jurowski. By design, his calendar now includes a lot of time at home in Berlin. There, he has led the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra since 2015. When not in Munich, he spends a welcome amount of time with his family, including his daughter, who works at the Komische Oper Berlin, where both Jurowski and his father have also conducted. Focusing on Germany has meant wrapping up in Britain, where Jurowski was the principal conductor of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and earlier, the music director of Glyndebourne Festival. He's also had a post in Russia leading the State Academic Symphony Orchestra of the Russian Federation, but his tenure there ended in 2021, independent of the war in Ukraine. Yurovsky has strong feelings about Russia under President Vladimir V. Putin and has been outspoken about the war. He renounced his Russian citizenship in 2000 as a condition of becoming a German citizen and declined an offer from the Russian government to reclaim it in 2014, the year Russia invaded and annexed Crimea. Another conductor, Theodor Korintsis, who has faced repeated scrutiny over his financial support from the Russian government, accepted a similar offer at the time. "They didn't seem to mind that I didn't serve in the military or that my parents had defected," Yurovsky said, referring to Russian officials. "They basically acted against their own law to do me a favor." Yurovsky has little family left in Russia, but maintains friendships with people there and has extremely active on social media in the days leading up to the country's most recent presidential election on March 17th, which extended Putin's reign to 2030. "If I'm posting something," Yurovsky said, "I see that a lot of people are viewing my post, but most of them are not replying, only people who are living outside Russia." He became especially vocal after the recent death of Alexei Navalny, Russia's most prominent opponent of Putin. "It has shaken my foundations," he said. "Now that he's gone, it's like the last hope for Russia is gone." Yurovsky remains determined to be both in tune with and opinionated about Russian politics. "Although he isn't a citizen, it is his home country," he said, "and I cannot just pretend that nothing happened, that I'm indifferent to it." He doesn't see himself returning there as a conductor, at least not while Putin is in power, and even then, not until Russia goes through a proper cleansing. This spirit of a citizen artist has been a major feature of Yurovsky's tenure in Munich, but not the only one. He entered with a mission to add what he called masterpieces of the 20th century, unjustly or forgotten music and contemporary music, to the company's vast repertoire. Hence, The Nose and The Devils of Loudoun. The house has also championed the Australian composer Brett Dean in both its opera and orchestral programming and will present a premiere by him in a future season. The orchestra has warmed to new scores increasingly quickly. "The collaboration is much easier," he said, "and getting to final results takes a much shorter span of time and much less effort." Yurovsky's partner in programming is Sergei Dorny, the house's manager, who also started in 2021 and said they speak the same language. "We suggest scores to each other, we have conversations, and it's always productive," Dorny said. "We want the same things. That extends the social identity of the company. We know what opera should be," he added, "and what an opera house should do, that a house should be political." The directors that pass through the Bavarian State Opera have been partners, too. Yurovsky has a reputation as a true opera conductor, engaged in the art form as theater. For new productions, he meets with directors early and often, and, remarkably, doesn't miss a single staging rehearsal if he can. Sometimes he has worked closely with directors to create new versions of scores or to restore previously conventional cuts, always with dramaturgical purpose. His War and Peace with Chekherniov excised about 30 minutes of material that was transparently written for Soviet censors. His Rosenkavalier with Barry Kosky, on the other hand, was unabridged, the third act longer, but smoother. "Each piece has its own character, its own personal features," Yurovsky said. "I treat pieces as persons. I'm trying to find out what they are, what it is they want, and what it is they lack." With Tobias Kratzer, the director of The Passenger, which contains scenes at Auschwitz, Yurovsky trimmed about a half hour from the running time. His cuts included getting rid of an unnecessary character and gratuitous representations of the concentration camp. The opera, which Weinberg wrote in 1968, didn't premiere until this century, and it hadn't been presented with edits until the Munich production. The result, the performance, the staging, and the architecture of the piece itself, was shattering and stark, far from the kitsch that it runs the risk of being. "He will stay after the rehearsal to solve a detailed problem, some problems you might have never thought of, that can keep you up at night," Kratzer said of Yurovsky. "But he's a great musician, and he knows that music is just one part of this world." The Bavarian State Opera is an openly partisan house, sometimes controversially. because opera houses in Germany received substantial state funding. During the country's refugee crisis a decade ago, it championed Willkommenskultur, or welcome culture, creating youth programs for the children of migrants to perform with their local peers. In 2022, it hung a large Ukrainian flag over the columns of its grand entrance. And when the Bayerische Staatsorchester, the house's pit orchestra, performed at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland last year, Yarowski didn't stop climate change protesters who stormed the stage during a Bruckner symphony. After a brief disruption, he told the audience that he had made a deal with them. They could speak their minds, then remain quiet for the rest of the concert. When audience members tried to shout down the protesters, Yarowski gestured for them to be respectful. He later exchanged emails with the two protesters from Renovate Switzerland, sharing his worries about the mounting crises of the world. But he told them, "I hardly believe that you are helping the environment by ruining a classical music concert." He argued for music as a source of spiritual comfort and for the need to protect it. It would have been better, he wrote, if they had contacted him before the concert so that the audience, admittedly very complicated and certainly a bit stuffy, would be more open to their message. Yarowski invited them to work together in the future, but they didn't respond to that message. Now he is thinking about programs with his Berlin orchestra that make space for speeches about climate change. In the interview in Munich, Yarowski said he was proud that the incident in Lucerne happened as he was representing the Bavarian State Opera, an institution that, he said, doesn't stick its head in the sand and pretend that we're just here to make beautiful music. But he does also make beautiful music, and will truly claim his place in the company's core repertoire next season when he leads the new Das Rheingold, directed by Kratzer, as well as a new Don Giovanni, two works with a rich tradition in Munich. "It's going to be a big challenge twice," Yarowski said. But after three seasons, he added, he feels prepared. And now he's looking forward to a possible second term. His contract ends in 2026, but he would need at least one additional year to finish The Ring. The decision, though, rests with the local government and not with the house itself. "I cannot influence it," he said, "so I shouldn't worry about it. If they offer me extension, I won't say no. If they want another change, I will move on. Life is full of surprises." I will switch to what to watch on TV as I keep on reading from the April 14th edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. The article is Fallout Finds the Fun in an Apocalyptic Hellscape, written by Austin Considine. The scream was just right, blood-curdlingly, if also very funny. And the practical effects crew had finally found the proper volume and trajectory of the water cannon. The idea was to film what might happen if you ripped a man from the throat of a mutant salamander, exploding its guts like a giant water balloon. All that remained was to decide what color of bile to slather on the actor, that is, Johnny Pemberton, and on the salamander's many teeth, which nuclear radiation had transformed into rows of human-like fingers. Based on observations made during a visit to the Brooklyn set of Fallout in early 2023, Amazon had spared no expense to make the show, the latest genre-bending series from Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, the creators of Westworld. So it was no surprise when Nolan, on set to direct that chilly afternoon, was presented with not one, but some half dozen buckets of bile to choose from in a variety of revolting hues. He settled on a pukey pinkish yellow. "It's the closest thing to comedy that I've worked on," he said later by phone. With writing credits on films like Memento, The Dark Knight, and The Prestige, Nolan has tended to skew dark, comically exploding monster guts. This was new territory. "It's a lot of fun," he said. A fun apocalypse? Amid all the doom and gloom of most sci-fi spectacles and social media feeds? Yes, please. Fallout premieres on Prime Video, and at first it may sound familiar to viewers of a certain post-apocalyptic HBO hit from last year, The Last of Us. Imagine a sprawling, expensive adaptation of a beloved video game franchise that features an unlikely duo, a nihilistic old gunslinger with a tortured past, and a tough young woman whose mission overlaps with his. Together, they travel a lawless America plagued by criminals, fanatics, killer mutants, and trigger-happy survivors. But where The Last of Us had a decidedly serious and heartfelt tone, Fallout, in keeping with its source material, is satirical and self-aware, rich with ironic detail. Sets and costumes lovingly blend B-movie conventions from multiple genres, including Westerns, horror, and Atomic Age sci-fi. The violence is comically over the top. That unlikely duo? The man, played by Walton Goggins, is a disfigured former Western star who, among other things, puts the woman, played by Ella Purnell, on a leash and tries to hawk her organs. Their overlapping mission? To find a severed head. I'm still wrapping my head around it, to be quite honest with you, Goggins said during a brief production break on set. He was dressed in kind of immaculate Hollywood cowboy duds. Think golden fringe and a tidy matching neckerchief that a real cowboy might spit a beer on. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly meets... He paused, searched for the perfect comparison. It's Strange Love meets the Star Wars bar. Until recently, live-action video game adaptations were mostly a losing proposition for television. The Last of Us, by most accounts, broke the streak. A commercial and critical darling, it earned 8 primetime Emmys in January, and its total of 24 nominations included one for the best drama. Such success seemed remote 5 years ago, when Nolan had his first conversations with Bethesda Game Studios, the company that owns the Fallout franchise. An avid gamer, Nolan had long been a fan. The original game, which debuted in 1997, established the premise. In an alternative America, the post-war optimism and kitschy aesthetics of the Eisenhower era never ended, only evolved. There was no Vietnam, no Watergate, no Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. Then, in 2077, a nuclear war between the United States and China wiped out modern civilization worldwide. Those who could afford it retreated into vast underground networks of shelters, known as vaults, until it was safe to come out. The game? It begins in 2161 when a vault dweller, who has never known anything but the beaver cleaver-ish culture preserved underground, ventures into the irradiated wastelands around Los Angeles on a vital mission. Later games travel to other cities and other times. Several Fallout adaptations had been aborted or turned down over the years, said Todd Howard, Bethesda's executive producer, who is also an executive producer of the show. After seeing and loving Westworld, however, Howard approached Nolan and Joy. He had heard Nolan was a gamer. He had clearly played a lot, Howard said, Fallout 3 especially. He could speak to it with authenticity and had a view of what made it tick. Fallout 3 was a game that you could play comfortably for 50 to 100 hours, Nolan said. Bethesda priorities were twofold. A TV series had to stay true to the lore of the games, but also be written like a whole new chapter, same as any game sequel. It was very important to us to not have a show that translated one particular game story, but that told something original, Howard said. The main character in the Fallout series is the world of Fallout. Amazon signed on to produce in 2020, part of an overall deal with Nolan and Joy's production company, Kilter Films. To begin building the Fallout world, Kilter brought in 2 creator showrunners. One, Geneva Robertson-Dworet, had written scripts for big adaptations before, including Tomb Raider in 2018 and Captain Marvel in 2019. The other, Graham Wagner, was a TV comedy writer with credits on Baskets, Silicon Valley, and 50 episodes of Portlandia. For them, it was a best-of-both-worlds situation. They had been given a trove of intellectual property to start with, already popular among millions. But they also had freedom to simply craft a good story without worrying so much about satisfying gamer fan police. "The fans of the games want to hear us say that we take the IP seriously," Wagner said in a joint interview with Robertson-Dworet. "Of course we do, because we like it. But you don't want to let that burden make it feel like a job. Because then everyone's watching you do a job, and then it just feels like work." Roberts and Dworet later added, laughing, "We talk a lot about the expletive we're going to eat for the show. It's going to be either too woke, too fascist, not fascist enough." She trailed off. The possibilities were endless. In a separate video call, Kyle MacLachlan, who plays a guest role in the show, didn't seem worried, and he knows something about protective fan bases. See David Lynch's Dune or David Lynch's Twin Peaks: The Return. "I think it's evident when you look at the sets and the production value and the tone of the show that they're making a big effort to try to incorporate the reality of that world," he said. "It's a perfect place to put a story." For all the new material, fans of the game will find plenty that is familiar about the story. The show's other male lead, played by Aaron Moten, plays an initiate of the Brotherhood of Steel, a fanatical warrior faction found in all of the games. They suit up in Iron Man-like robotic armor that, 219 years after the end of modern civilization, is prone to breaking down. Though Purnell's character arrives over 130 years after the events of the first game, she draws heavily from it. "She goes up to the wasteland, she finds out that everything she ever believed is a lie," Purnell said in a video call with Moten. "It makes her start to question everything," she added. "And she has to make that choice, right? Adapt or die. Who's she going to be?" However fans respond to Fallout, no one can doubt the creator's commitment. Back in Brooklyn in early 2023, a set tour with the show's production designer, Howard Cummings, offered a glimpse of the massive scope. Indoors, a maze-like series of corridors and chambers amounted to a multi-level reproduction of the vaults. Outdoors, a ramshackle junk city included whole buses and the front end of a 747 jet trucked in from California. The New York production alone had 35 welders working at once, Cummings said. This was to say nothing of the location shoots in the Utah desert or on the skeleton coast in Namibia, a stand-in for a post-apocalyptic Pacific Palisades, all shot on widescreen film instead of digital. "The power of dragging yourself to a beautiful and remote place to capture that beauty on film, it still works," Nolan said. "It always works." Or of the 360-degree virtual soundstage made up of thousands of LED tiles for when you need the location to come to you. "New York didn't have one," Cummings said, "but it does now." Unsurprisingly, Fallout looks great. Still, all the money in Amazon's coffers can't make a show good, and the streamer, which declined to share budget numbers, has reportedly spent hundreds of millions of dollars on large-scale series like Citadel and The Lord of the Rings: The Rings of Power that have yet to make much of an impact with viewers or critics. Amid the glut of heavier end times material out there, it seemed like a refreshing start, at least, that the Fallout creator's goal was to entertain viewers, not pile onto them. Nolan called it making it an expiating experience. Coming out of a pandemic amid global instability and a deterioration of political discourse, you had to laugh sometimes, he said. It's the only way to make it through. Our next topic is art and design. Author Julia Halperin gives us the article "Indigenous Artists Are the Heart of the Venice Biennale." Before visitors step into any gallery at the 2024 Venice Biennale, which opens April 20th, Indigenous artists will have made their presence known. A collective of painters from the Brazilian Amazon under MACU, Movimento dos Artistas Uniquin, will cover the facade of the central exhibition hall with an intricate mural. Inutek Storch, the first Greenlandic and Inuit artist to represent Denmark at the International Art Festival, will erect a sign reading Kalaallit Nunaat, or Greenland, above the pavilion's entrance. Greenland has been a self-governing country within the Danish realm since 1979. The Brazil Pavilion nearby has been renamed the Hawapua Pavilion, one of many terms that indigenous people used to describe the territory that, after colonization, became Brazil. There is a very political aspect to the indigenous presence in an artistic space like the Venice Biennale, said Denilson Baniwa, the Hauapua Pavilion's co-curator. Our aim is to rewrite history and add a new chapter to art history. Beyond the United States Pavilion, which features the art of Jeffrey Gibson, the Venice Biennale offers a taste of the wide range of work produced by Indigenous, First Nations, and Native artists around the globe. Here are some of the highlights. The Central Exhibition. Indigenous artists are at the heart of Foreigners Everywhere, the Venice Biennale's Central Exhibition. As the Brazilian curator Adriano Pedrosa, artistic director of this year's Biennale, sees it, the indigenous artist is frequently treated as a foreigner in his or her own land. The first gallery at the Arsenal, Venice's former shipyard complex, will host a monumental installation by the Matahau Collective, a group of four Maori women known for making large-scale fiber sculptures. The 331-artist lineup also includes the Native American artist Kay Walking Stick and Emmy Whitehorse, the Brazilian Yanomami artist Yoseka Mokahesi, and Andre Taniki, Indigenous Australian artist Marlene Gilson and Namuapu Mamuro White, and Maori artist Sandy Adset and Selwyn Wilson, considered one of the founders of Maori modernism, who died in 2002. Next is the Australian Pavilion. Archie Moore of Queensland spent more than 4 years piecing together his family tree, which now stretches back centuries and encompasses 3,484 people. The story of his ancestors, Bigambul and Kamalia Mori on his mother's side, British and Scottish on his father's side, is the subject of his show at the Australia Pavilion, which he describes as a holographic map of identity. Moore, who is best known for recreating his childhood home as an art installation, is the second First Nations artist to represent Australia at the Biennale, after Tracy Moffat in 2017. With this project, he said, "I am bringing past family members into the present and the future, where they can be viewed more humanely." The next pavilion we'll discuss is Brazil Jahuapé. The centerpiece of this exhibition is a mantle, or feathered cape, created by the artist and activist Glicéria Tupinambá, with the help of her community in southern Bahia. Only a dozen mantles survive from the colonial period, and until recently all were in European museums. Denmark's National Museum announced plans to return one to Brazil last year. Glicéria hadn't seen a mantle in person until she visited Paris in 2018. There, she realized her ancestors employed the same stitching technique to create the cape that the Tupinambá now used to create fishing nets. Glicéria's contemporary mantle will be paired with a video installation by Olinda Tupinambá and a work by Zélle Carapoto, made from fishing nets and replicas of ballistic projectiles. The project by Glicéria, who in 2010 was jailed in Brazil for several months with her two-month-old baby after speaking out about police brutality, has an explicitly political bent. It includes letters Glicéria wrote to six European museums requesting the return of mantles in their collections. Next, we explore the Danish Pavilion. This year's Danish Pavilion represents many firsts. It is the first time a Greenlandic artist has represented Denmark, and the first time the country's presentation has been dedicated entirely to photography. At 35, the Inuk artist Inutek Storch is also the youngest ever to take over the hallowed space. Visitors will encounter a kaleidoscope of images, including snapshots of Storch's friends smoking and driving around his hometown Sisimiut, a slideshow of Storch's vast family photo archive, and formal portraits taken by John Moeller, a Greenlandic photographer who died in 1935. Although Greenland has been photographed extensively since the mid-1800s, Storch noted that it has rarely been captured by its own people. "My works serve as my artistic means to subtly and intricately modify the prevailing perception of my country," he said in a statement. The next pavilion is the Timor-Leste. Asia's youngest nation, Timor-Leste, will make its Venice Biennale debut with an installation by Maria Madeira. Born in the village of Gleno, Madeira was airlifted to Portugal after Indonesia invaded Timor-Leste in 1975. She spent 7 years in a refugee camp outside Lisbon before her family resettled in Perth, Australia. Timor-Leste celebrates the 25th anniversary of its independence from Indonesia this year. Madeira's installation, made from materials including the textile teis and betel nut, an ancient stimulant that grows on native palm trees, is conceived as a tribute to the resilience of Timorese women. During the Biennale's opening week, Madeira will perform live, kissing the exhibition's walls to leave lipstick marks behind, and singing a traditional mourning song in the indigenous language Tetun. Next topic, as I read from the April 14th edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, is dance. The article is a protest set to banjo, Jamar Roberts' dance for Hard Times, written by Brian Siebert. This isn't fun. That's what the choreographer Jamar Roberts told members of the Martha Graham Dance Company at a recent rehearsal of We the People, his first work for the troupe. The anti-fun note was needed because the music suggested otherwise. We the People is set to rearranged songs from You're the One, the latest and most playful album by the singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens. It's rocking chair porch music or accompaniment for a foot-stomping hoedown. But Roberts' dance, which will have its New York premiere on April 17th as part of the Graham Company's season at New York City Center, isn't a hoedown. It's a protest, dressed in denim. The costumes are by Karen Young. For much of the work, the dancers face the audience confrontationally, fists raised. They move fast and hard, as if yelling at people, as Roberts put it in an interview after the rehearsal. In one sense, this attitude rubs against the tone and associations of the music. In another, that friction, like a bow across strings, brings out the pain, rage, and resistance hidden within the sound. You might even say it brings to the surface what Alvin Ailey, in whose company Roberts was a dancer for nearly 20 years and resident choreographer from 2019 to 2022, called blood memories. An outcome of Roberts' artistic proclivities, this resurfacing is also, in an indirect way, what Janet Eilber, the Graham Company's artistic director, had in mind. She said that the plan to pair Roberts with Giddens arose out of a possible revival of Rodeo, a 1942 cowboy ballet by Agnes DeMille, a path-breaking choreographer who was also a Graham acolyte and biographer. It includes tap and square dancing. We wanted to open the conversation about how the American vernacular dance in Rodeo emerged out of immigrant and enslaved communities, she said. Someone directed Eilber to Giddens, whose career has been largely devoted to uncovering and reclaiming the cross-cultural black and white roots of string band music and the black history of the banjo. While pursuing that mission, she has earned a MacArthur Fellowship, Grammy Awards, and a Pulitzer Prize with Michael Abels for their opera Omar. Recently, the mission got a Beyoncé bump through Giddens' contributions to the pop star's Cowboy Carter album, which has raised discussions about the blackness of country music. Asked to reimagine Aaron Copland's genre-defining score for Rodeo, Giddens suggested Gabe Witcher of the Punch Brothers instead. At City Center, his bluegrass band will play his rearrangement. Wanting a companion piece for this version, Eilber asked Roberts to use Giddens' music, similarly rearranged by Witcher, to make a work that would offer a more expansive and inclusive vision of America. The City Center season, which combines Rodeo and We the People, and starts the company's centennial celebrations 2 years early, is called American Legacies. Although he is a longtime fan of Giddens' music, Roberts said he had difficulty finding his way in. He kept getting caught up in the stories told in her lyrics, which are stripped away in Witcher's all-instrumental arrangement. Songs for me were really light, he said. I was trying to think of a way to bring them down a little bit. He came up with silent interludes. In the first, Leslie Andrea Williams alternates between lifting her chest so high that she might lift off and doubling over, deflating like a leaky balloon. In another, a phalanx of female dancers juts and stomps aggressively. In a third, Lloyd Knight stretches into a Black Power salute and curls into a ball. He sinks to the ground, hinged at his knees, then lies prone with his hands behind his back, ready for handcuffs. "It's not that I'm against fun pieces," Robert said, "but America's having a hard time right now. As a black gay man from a southern black family, it's been really hard for me and people like me, but so many stories besides my own become of great importance in the piece." Giddens said in a phone interview that she was amazed by the results. "It is really saying so many of the things I wanted to say without even knowing that I wanted to say them." Another Wasted Life, a song that Giddens wrote about Khalif Browder, who committed suicide after being imprisoned for 3 years without a trial, isn't in We the People, but she feels the ghost of it in the dance. "I tend to downplay my banjo tunes," she said, "but there's actually a lot of them. My sound on the 1850 replica minstrel banjo that I play is centered in pain as well as joy. There's a story in the music, and Gabe and Jamar found it." "Rhiannon and I do the same kind of work," Robert said. "This excavation, making old things new, bringing hidden stories to light. We're in the same tribe." Such excavation is in the Graham tradition, too, as Robert knows. Although he comes from outside the Graham company, he was trained in her technique. One of his most important teachers was Peter London, who was a principal dancer with the Graham troupe. Robert said that he sees himself more as a modern dance choreographer in the line of a Graham than as a contemporary one following more recent trends. "The Graham vocabulary has always been in my body," he said, "and it's always been in my work." We the People includes flashes of American vernacular dance, twisty footwork suitable for a barn dance. But as in Graham's Appalachian Spring, these touches are transformed by a modern dance approach. Contraction and release, the core of Graham technique, which she called a dramatization of breathing, is constitutional in We the People. At that recent rehearsal, though, it sometimes seemed as if Roberts had to teach the Graham dancers how to move with the right full body attack. "They're so steeped in that tradition," he said, "that when I come in and ask them to do something a little different, alongside Graham-based movement, taking out of a Graham context, it feels like their bodies get confused. We're working on that." Robert said that being a freelance choreographer, lately he's made work for the likes of New York City Ballet and San Francisco Ballet, can make him feel ungrounded, lacking a familiar language between himself and the dancers he's hired to work with. But he isn't so far outside the Graham company. Knight is one of his best friends. They trained at the same Miami school as teenagers. And Alessio Crognall Roberts, who does a solo during one of the silent interludes, is married to Roberts. "I couldn't not give him a solo," Roberts said. "He represents the LGBTQ community," Roberts said of his husband's role. "There is this struggle in his body between being liberated and having to conform." Crognall Roberts is also an immigrant from Italy. "Hustling, trying to fulfill his dreams," Robert said. That's in the solo, too. Williams and Knight, the other two soloists, are black. "Dancers in the Graham company are often typecast," Williams said, "with black dancers playing the powerful or sexy roles, or maybe the mother figure." "I felt like he knew me," she said of Roberts. "It felt so special to have someone see me for me instead of fitting me into an archetype." Until recently, black choreographers working for Graham have been scarce. One of the only requests that Giddens made of Roberts, he said, was that he center black dancers. "It's like, what is the purpose?" she said in her interview. "What kind of shockwaves can this send out after it's over? We're trying to create systemic change, and if there's an opportunity to foreground black artists, we should take it." "That doesn't mean that it has to be quote-unquote black story," she continued. "Actually, it's better if it's not." What she liked about seeing Williams and Knight featured in We the People, she said, was that it just felt normal. noting that there has been a lot of performative diversity and inclusion lately, Giddens gave the Graham Company credit for hiring artists, giving them support, and staying out of the way. "People are trying to mend ways that have been set in stone for a long time," she said, calling for grace. "Jamar and I wanted to use this opportunity to make something that answers something in us, and we did." For Roberts, the protest stance is a new direction, and it makes him nervous. "It's so simple that it feels a little cringe," he said. But he also thinks it might be potent. "It's the start of a conversation," he said. Our next article is an interview with George Takei. It's written by Leanne Jackson. When George Takei talks about his childhood, he speaks of both anguish and beauty. The actor, best known as Sulu from Star Trek, was only 5 when he and his family, like thousands of Japanese-American citizens during World War II, were relocated from their Los Angeles home to a string of incarceration camps. Takei captured some of his family's wartime experiences in a horse stall in Arcadia, California, a camp in Rower, Arkansas, another one in Northern California, in his picture book, My Lost Freedom, due out April 16th. "This is an American story that Americans need to know about," he said in a video call. The book continues his mission to shed light on a dark chapter in U.S. history. It follows his 1994 autobiography, To the Stars, his 2019 graphic memoir, They Called Us Enemy, and the 2015 musical production, Allegiance, which was inspired by his life. Takei, aged 86, discussed meeting dignitaries with his husband Brad, as well as the keepsakes he treasures and his one healthy addiction. These are edited excerpts from that conversation. First, he talked about seeing your work in lights. "I got a phone call that the marquee for Allegiance was going up at 8 a.m. Our apartment was so close to Longacre Theater in Manhattan, we ran down there to see the letters being put there. It was thrilling, a life landmark experience. I wished both my parents could be there." Next, we talked about big band. "At Rower, my father arranged to borrow a record player from the camp administration every couple of months, and after dinner, the tables were dragged away. The benches were put off to the side, and the teenagers got to have a dance. My bedtime music was the music from the mess hall. I still get a lump in my throat when I hear big band music from the 1940s. Next, I talked to him about Mount Fuji. "My parents loved sending me to summer school. There was a session in Tokyo at Sophia University. I think I was 17. One of the guys came up with this idea. They allow people to climb up to the top of Mount Fuji. Would you guys want to do that?" About a dozen of us said, "Yeah." "When you begin, they sell you this staff. At each station, they have an old man with a branding iron who'll mark the staff. That's proof that you reached the station. I have the whole staff with the final branding." Then there are dining with presidents stories. "Brad and I are a gay couple. I was raised in an American prison camps, and we went to a state dinner in the White House as guest of President Clinton in 1999 to welcome Prime Minister Obuchi to Washington. And I got another invitation from President Obama to meet and greet Prime Minister Abe and his wife in 2015. Obama puts us on the dais. I was seated next to the First Lady of Japan, and Brad was seated next to Nancy Pelosi. How about that?" There are memories of the Sydney Opera House. "A couple of years ago, we were in Australia, and Brad was dealing with jet lag by going to bed. My attitude is, you've got to walk around and get the blood coursing and a sense of the place where you are. I was walking along, and there was this street lamp advertising the Phantom of the Opera at Sydney Opera House. So I rushed back to the hotel. I woke Brad up and said, 'We're going to go to the theater.' It was a fantastic production." Then I asked about the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. George Takei responded, "It's one of the premier institutions in America, the place for anyone doing any kind of research on that chapter of American history. I'm a former chairman of the board. I'm still on the board of trustees, and I founded that museum with others." we talked about shellfish in Australia. For Blood Oath, we filmed right near Moreton Bay. They have these crustaceans that look like bugs, a mid-sized crab with 1,000 tiny legs. They said this was a unique dish to Queensland. It's a combination of the consistency of oysters and the flavor of lobster and shrimp. You have to taste it to know what it's really like. It is so indescribably good. What about the Olympic torch? In 1984, Takei said, the idea was having runners carry the Olympic flame every 5 kilometers all the way to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. Star Trek producer Harve Bennett said, well, George, you're a runner. Paramount would love to sponsor you. It was the most heady run, and I got to keep the uniform and the torch. What about Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles? To which George Takei had this response. When we came out of camp in 1946, the whole world opened up, and the Chinese Theater was a glamorous place for me. You'll find my name, together with my Star Trek colleagues, right there on that sidewalk. And finally, we talked about green tea. George Takei said, I carry Ito and Oi Ocha tea bags around. They have lots of antioxidants that help you live long and prosper. I drink it every day, all day. I am an addict. Well, that is it for this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times, the April 14th issue. I'm Rob Lund. Have a great day, and thank you for listening to Chris.